listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The attacks on President Donald Trump from all quarters seem to step up again this past week. Portions of a book by former Watergate Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward were released, alleging chaos inside the White House. And before the book's release, now set for September 11th, an anonymous editorial was published in the New York Times from a person the Times claimed was an insider at the White House, which appeared to ratify some of Woodward's claims. The author of the editorial found fault with President Trump's policy towards Russia in particular, as not being aggressive enough. Meanwhile, Russia and China are about to begin joint military exercises, the largest such exercises since 1981. For all that and more, we spoke with Professor Tony Montero via Skype from Philadelphia Thursday.
We are at the end of the beginning and the start of a new phase, right on time for the midterm elections.
Yeah.
And it's obvious that the midterm elections are about impeachment. Yeah. You know, they were trying to deny it, but it's very clear now. Even the so-called socialist within the Democratic Party, the young women who are winning primaries over old guard, mainly pro-Hillary Democrats, even they are pro-impeachment. Mm. And that's obvious. But then at another level, there is the intelligence services who are pushing for the coup d'etat option.
Right.
Some call it a soft coup. We've called it a moving coup d'etat. But however you look at it, if the Democrats take the House back, then it will be a signal for the intelligence services, sometimes what they call the deep state, to step up every effort to effect a coup d'etat, an overthrow. Now, it's obvious that in that letter, this is a letter of coup plotters. I mean, pardon me, the opinion piece is the thinking of the coup plotters within the administration itself or around the administration. And they you know, in this opinion piece, I don't know if everybody's looked at it, but one of the things that they talk about is that early on in the administration, there were efforts to organize an immediate coup, and that was through the 25th Amendment or through which would go into effect if a number of members of the administration, cabinet secretaries and others, came to the Congress and said that Trump was no longer fit to govern morally or intellectually or psychologically.
Right.
And therefore, there would be the conditions. Now, how that would work, nobody knows, but the conditions to remove him from office. So for all of the time that he's been in office, there have been plots and plans to carry out a coup d'etat. And now the question is why? And I think we've made this clear over the months because of his position on things like NAFTA, TPP, NATO, detente with Russia, a pullback of the military, and a different approach to world politics and a move away from hegemonism and unipolarity to a multipolar world. This is his approach to world politics. It has everything to do with empire and U.S. imperialism at this stage. And the ones that are least able to see it are the phony left in this country.
It's frightening.
Which is so fake and so silly and so infantile that no one can take them seriously.
Yeah. It's you know, this is when I was a kid, I don't know, maybe in my early teens maybe or something, when I first started hearing this and trying to apply it to something that I was, you know, focusing on, the term ivory tower. This is like textbook. The people are so it's amazing to me how many people that are like in the left leadership positions or somehow how they got there. And there's another question altogether, but are ivory tower types. In other words, even though they may have their little, you know, rooms where they organize people together and they have the little meetings and all of that stuff and whatever rules they inherited from Rousseau or Lenin or whatever to run the meetings, they're really completely disconnected from reality.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, and whatever formulations they come up with about what's going on around them, you know, it's like it's based off a slide rule instead of touching a piece of material somewhere. It's just pretty scary. You know, you're looking at this article. There's the problem with Trump is in foreign policy. Is that he was reluctant to expel so many of Mr. Putin's spies as punishment for the poisoning of a former Russian spy in Britain. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm hired by the White House to work in the White House. And instead, I'm stealing papers off his desk, as this person says, because I don't like his foreign policy. And that is what they offer for it. This, first of all, most of those people were either spies, like all diplomats are spies, or not spies, because they're diplomats. So that's what they do. And the poisoning of a former Russian spy, there's been no trial, there's no proof, there's no nothing. To undermine the president from inside the White House over something shaky as that, and then say that you're the steady hand and he's the lunatic, you know, to me, that sounds... they were talking about treason with Putin. Having a meeting with Putin was treason. This is treason. This is criminal, This ought to be prosecuted. And this is the kind of thing in a lot of places in the world, people get executed for it, and a lot of those places are allies of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think that the fact that we are seeing the word treason being used so regularly against opponents, in other words, John Brennan, I think probably first used it or got the biggest recognition or publicity in the press for using it when Trump met with Putin. Now Putin is pointing the treasonous finger, the finger of treason, back at his opponents. I think we have to see that as symbolic of a stage in the political crisis of the country.
Yeah.
And how each side have now reached a point where there can be no compromise, that it is a zero-sum game. Either both sides see it as a fight to the death. And you might remember a couple of weeks ago, Trump said that if he is impeached, it will lead to violence. And I think his evaluation is accurate.
Right.
His base has not been moved one iota by all of this.
Right.
The polls show that the sides are still divided the way they were at the time of the election.
Yep.
The question is, I think, where the younger generation will fall, who for the most part have been above the fray, not involved in it, a bit confused by it, and by the youth, their seeking of leadership, will forces like Antifa, who I believe is a completely infiltrated organization, whether they will assume the high ground, whether the phony left and the liberal left, which in a larger sense are part of this moving coup d'etat, will capture the imagination of the young people, or whether or not a leadership that understands what is at stake, and what is at stake is whether or not the intelligence and security forces, in alignment with the neoliberals and neocons, can overturn a duly elected president. And if that occurs, we're at a new stage of the consolidation of extra-legal political power on the part of forces who are, in fact, committed to U.S. empire and U.S.
hegemony,
and are prepared to resume the march towards war with Russia and intervention in Syria. And and we could say a little bit more about Syria in this particular moment of Idlib and other things, but that's the way I see it. The opposition to Trump is the most aggressive, militarist, military-oriented group within the ruling class.
Yeah, I think the hegemony is the key word there. This is the group that you know seized their multipolar moment from 1991 as, you know, that being the end of history. They published that in an anonymous article in the New York
Times. The unipolar, not multipolar. They went to the unipolar.
That's right, the unipolar.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, okay, first, they're looking at the elections here, and they've got everybody, you know, they're working the Democratic Party base with this, impeachment threat. You know, they're every day, it's hard, you know, it's about to happen, et cetera. No matter what happens with the election, and I want to talk about that for a minute also in a second, but they have to flip the Senate, and there's barely enough seats up for that to happen, and no candidates really that are offering it, because in order to the impeachment is like an indictment. That's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then there's the removal from office, which is like a conviction. The impeachment takes place in the House.
If I could just interrupt you.
Yeah, yeah.
You see, they realize that taking the House back would be to begin like a grand jury.
Right. That's what it is.
A trial where they put forward the indictments and the particulars of the indictment.
Right.
Well, but that becomes a platform.
Yeah, of course.
To wage a national political campaign against him. They know that they're not going to take the Senate back, and therefore they cannot remove him by legal or constitutional means via impeachment.
Right.
But they can use these other means. And I think this anonymous op-ed piece in the New York Times begins to suggest that there are coup plotters within the administration and close to the administration.
Yeah.
And the other thing is this anonymous op-ed is a way of destabilizing and creating a paranoia and nervousness within the small group that is committed to Trump and keeping him in office.
It's a psyop,
I think we're looking at the uses of extra legal means of removing him from office.
Yep.
And the reason I say it's a zero-sum game, the forces opposed to him are not in the mood for any type of compromise. It's either him out or nothing.
Right.
And that's the way they're playing it. And we see it in these hearings for Kavanaugh's appointment to the Supreme Court, the disruption by Harris and Booker, Cory Booker, and these kind of you know, so-called women's rights activists and so on and so forth, which is nothing but the neoliberal Democratic Party organization. I mean, this is so obvious what is going on, and not to oppose it, to be indifferent to it or complicit with it is, in fact, since they want to use the word fascism, is a form of the collaboration with fascism.
Yeah. You know, when you're talking about, look, abortion rights are very important, for example. And so, you know, a discussion about abortion rights and the Supreme Court nominee is definitely an important thing. You have a discussion about free speech around Kaepernick and you know, the knee, quote unquote, and football and all of that. You have basically a coup d'etat that's underway in the United States, and this guy's on one side, and the CIA and the press and all of them are on the other side. And people want to instead divide up sides about how they feel about abortion or genuflecting at a football game or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that is being encouraged, whipped up by every kind of media out here. And the heads of the alternative media are being kept in full view of the world and their stockholders in these Senate hearings and House hearings to make sure that they have a finger on them. And, and so no one is talking about this actual threat at the moment. And there's something something else. You pointed this out to me back early in the 2016 election, like in 2015. And that was to not mistake the candidates for the movements that are lifting them up. And
absolutely.
When you look at the phenomenon that's developing in the Democratic Party with respect to these unexpected winners in the primaries, on the one hand, I wouldn't vote for any of them for dog catcher any more than I would vote for Clinton or Trump or any of the others, on the one hand. On the other hand, their being elected has less to do, in my opinion, because all of the Democrats are saying that they would impeach Trump. So that kind of filters out. Has less to do with that and more to do with the way that they are distinct from the Democratic Party that exists now. Socialism, you know, all these things that represent the same kinds of forces that were starting to gather behind Sanders. The problems that gave rise to Sanders voters and Trump voters have not gone away. And the Trump voters feel that Trump has been trying to make them go away and being frustrated by everybody else. And the others know that the solution, because the ones that lived through it with Sanders know that the solution isn't to sit down and play ball with whatever the Democratic Party regurgitates at the end of an election. So what's going to happen after the election this year?
Well, see, this is the whole thing. So-called socialist or the so-called Sanders Democrats do not have a program or a vision to go forward. And this is just, I think, an effort to rebrand the Democratic Party and to so-called broaden it, its base and activate the youth, women, and what they call minority voters to believe that the party that they abandoned in 2016 is a new kind of party, and in 2018 they should rush back to this party. Whether that will happen is not clear at this point. But you're right. The overhanging issue is a moving, or what some call a soft coup d'etat. And you cannot separate any of these electoral processes in the 2018 midterm election from what the intelligence services are doing and from the whole thing of Russiagate and the right to remove Trump because he was illegally and illegitimately elected because of the involvement of a foreign hostile power. That's the bottom line. And unless that is confronted head on, there's nothing else that you can talk about. That is the driving force of politics at this moment in the United States. And the kind of brinksmanship in domestic politics of both the Democrats and the so-called left or liberal left coordinated with the CIA and FBI, which have been the traditional enemies of anti-war and leftist and progressive forces. I mean, this is horrendous. It is horrible. And it is a betrayal by the left and progressives of all that they have stood for all of these many years. I mean, this is unacceptable. But, you know, the other thing, Don, is the situation in Syria and the fact that Trump has made troubling and dangerous statements about Idlib. Well, but let's look at on the ground. The Russians have a powerful naval fleet, including cruisers and missile ships that can launch missiles and submarines in the Eastern Mediterranean. In Syria, the Russians and the Iranians and the Hezbollah are joined now by Chinese forces, small force, but nonetheless, they're there.
Yep.
The Assad government is not going to be overthrown. That's clear. Now, this kind of maneuvering around Idlib and of course, it's unclear what Turkey's role is, although Turkey and Russia and Iran are in discussions regularly about how to restore peace in Syria. Merkel and Putin met a couple of weeks in Germany, and one of the things on the table was the repatriation of Syrian refugees and financing the their return to Syria and even the redevelopment, rebuilding of the country. I mean, so on the one side, Trump is talking brinksmanship, but on the other side, it's a hollow threat.
Right. Yeah, he's been actually, you know, he's been standing down while Russia, Iran, Hezbollah have been, and Syria, have been winning the war, and this is the last major battle. You know, while this is going on, in other words, while the Syria situation is about to be settled, and while shaking out around that is apparently a new relationship between Turkey and Russia, for example. You have this whole circus that's, you know, it's a sequence of events. First, the guy that, you know, one of the two guys that were credited, the sane one, because we saw his partner at the RNC, and I don't think they want to make him a front man, Carl Bernstein. You know, he comes out with a, I got a president in 1974 and 75, so I'm the go-to guy for getting the next one. Here's my book, okay? And then it gets massive coverage, and then it's ratified, basically, by an anonymous, close to the president, White House source in an editorial page editorial from the New York Times. So all of that rolls out, and you got to ask yourself, how exactly those sequence of events can happen? Who can make those things happen? You know, who are the few people that can do that, and whose interest do they serve? Well, while the world is seeing that, you know, at the same time, Russia and China are beginning joint military exercises, the largest military exercises Russia's done since really 1981. And China yesterday escorted a British ship that was going into position in the South China Sea. In other words, they're anticipating that something may go down here, it looks like, and they're, you know, putting the material and manpower in place to defend.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, and we can never lose sight of these world developments. And you know, add to that the crisis of currencies in the emerging market zone of the world economy, including big ones like Turkey and Argentina and South Africa and India. And this blowing up of the value of the dollar at the expense of these other currencies, and really at it's like a short term, let's make some money type of thing in the midst of an administration that really cannot govern or is being hamstrung in its ability to govern. These are the money market hedge fund people who are playing loose and reckless with the world economy. So we have almost a perfect storm of crises converging at this time. And I would say that the eye of the storm is Washington and the United States. So, you know, tighten up your seatbelts, man. Yeah. This is going to be a rocky ride, man.
You know, it's interesting also. We got about 2 minutes left, 3 minutes left. Argentina in particular is an interesting case because the so-called conservative restoration that the U.S. imposed on Brazil, Argentina, Honduras, a number of other places in Latin America, Argentina is kind of the flagship of that. And they got to reimpose their neoliberal economic policies in Buenos Aires. And there's been, you know, strong resistance from the working class there. But Macri has been, you know, one of their good soldiers, and it doesn't matter that they're kicking his legs out from underneath them. So if you cannot restore neoliberal economics to one of these countries without provoking its almost immediate collapse, they don't have many quivers left, you know, many arrows left in their quiver.
And, you know, Don, let us not forget about the Brazilian elections where Lula is in prison, but he's leading in the polls.
That's right, I know. But they won't let him run, even though the UN says he should be able to run.
So,
I mean, look, it's crisis, 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 crisis. You know, one of two, well, there's a multiplicity, I guess, but one of two likely outcomes of the election season in this November would be either Democrats make large gains or They don't. And there's pretty much, you know, status quo ante at the end of the day. Assuming in each case, what do you see the dynamics, any change in the dynamics or just a slow continuation towards this same thing we've been seeing the move towards?
Well, there are 50 congressional seats that where the real battle is going to take place. And in a lot of ways, these battleground seats are really what will decide it is the white working class. The white working class and lower middle classes. Now, in some instances in these districts, you have a small African-American or Latino minority who can be critical, however they go or whether they vote at all. But in a lot of ways, this is a battle for the soul of the white working class. And that's why Richard Trumka, head of the AFL-CIO, and other labor leaders coming out supporting Trump's renegotiation of NAFTA could be very decisive in these battles.
Yeah, and just for our listeners' benefit, we have 435 House seats. All of them are up. And yeah. Then we have 33 Senate seats out of the 100 Senate seats. And yeah, 50 is about right. You're talking about essentially 10% of those seats where they're contested and where control of the House may flip.
Yes, yes.
And yeah. With that, again, maybe you can get impeachment. Maybe you can't. But you can certainly, if the Democrats gain control of the House, for example, they get to elect a speaker, and the speaker sets a lot of agenda and gets a lot of face time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And still, whichever way the midterm elections go, the intelligence services, in conjunction with the neocons and neoliberal elites, are still going to push for a coup d'etat, right, to remove this guy from office by any means necessary.
Okay, Tony, we're going to keep an eye on it, as we've been doing since the election. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much, Don.
Thank you, too. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. As the Syrian Arab Army embarks upon liberating the last major anti-government area of Idlib, tensions are high. This international proxy conflict looks to be coming to an end. For all intents and purposes, Assad has won. This is an outcome Washington and its regional allies refuse to accept. Crosstalking Syria, I'm joined by my guest, Sami Hamdi, in London. He's the editor-in-chief of International Interests, as well as a geopolitical risk consultant. And in Beirut, we cross to Marwak Osman. She's a journalist and university lecturer. All right, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Marwak, let me go to you first in Beirut, because there seems to be a constellation of forces that are coming together. Tensions are very, very high. We have an official in the U.S. government speaking to the Washington Post that the U.S. is intentionally keeping Syria a quagmire to get what they want. I'm paraphrasing what Washington wants. We also have the American fleet being bolstered up off the coast of Syria in the Mediterranean. The Russians are doing the same thing. The Russians are warning the world that there could be a false flag chemical attack, which, of course, John Bolton of the National Security Council has said if there is some kind of chemical attack, the U.S. would get involved. This is a bad train wreck happening right before our eyes. Who wants all the tension here? Go ahead in Beirut.
Well, I would start by saying that that statement coming from the U.S. might be the most honest statement to be said for the past 7 years, meaning keeping Syria as a quagmire, because that is exactly what the U.S. strategy is in Syria. No strategy for Syria. That's what it is. So basically, Russia and the Syrian Arab Army or the air force of the Syrian Arab Army have been pausing the offensive against Idlib for the past 22 days, and they started again about a week or less than a week ago. They started the offensive after giving 22 days of possible negotiations, whether with the terrorists for some sort of a channel for them to come clean and maybe go home, wherever they came from, and a chance for the displaced people, for the people who are afraid of the terrorists or afraid to get maybe squeezed within the bombardment campaign to leave the area, and as well for the U.S. to try and put a frame on its strategy. Try and tell the world what it wants from Syria, because obviously, just like you said, it is very obvious that President Bashar Assad has won the war, has retaken control over the land that was taken by ISIS, by al-Qaeda, and by the other al-Qaeda affiliates around Damascus and on the outskirts of governorates that are on the outskirts of the country. Now, what the U.S. wants, basically, we cannot know. But what we know is they have been aiding certain groups on the eastern side of Syria. They also have been aiding certain groups on the southern part of Syria. Now, in Idlib, that's a very big question of who are they actually listening to or who are they helping? Because we have more than 70,000 insurgents, 10,000 of which are actually designated by the UN as terrorists.
Okay. Sammy, how do you reflect upon all that? Because, you know, at least on my side of the divide, and we differ, and that's why I'm glad you're on the program here, it looks like the U.S. and its allies, including Israel, recent reports of the kind of aid that Israel has given to rebels and other groups, you know, rebels, terrorists, we can use all these terms here, but that's come to light here. I mean, it seems to me, on my side of the divide, is that the U.S. and its allies are protecting al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda-type characters in Idlib. That's the perception here. How do you reflect upon that? Go ahead, Sammy.
I think it's very important that we don't lump everybody and say U.S. and their allies, because each of these allies, as you mentioned them, has a different strategy. I think I agree with Marwa that the U.S. doesn't have a strategy. It tried to prop up the Kurds as a viable political card to use against Assad in the event that he won the war and in the event Damascus would lean towards Moscow. I think Israel is very limited its involvement to just curbing the Iranian influence and no more than that. It seems that every time Iran gets closer to the border, Israel gets involved, Iran comes back a little bit, Israel goes back home. The Turks are heavily involved. The Turks are the ones who have links to the rebel movement. Some of these members of these rebel movements have declared links to al-Qaeda. That's very true. However, we should be wary that we should not paint the whole Syrian revolution as one that is being dominated by these terrorist groups. It's true that they are powerful factions in the terrorist organizations, but it is the very failure of the US and the international community to support the desires of the Syrian people that allowed the terrorist groups to come to the fore in the first place. It was the failure of the international community to back the Free Syria Army when it was made up of honest Syrians looking for a very respectable and dignified life after years of dictatorship. That failure allowed the likes of ISIS and al-Qaeda to come to the fore. I also think we should be wary when we say Assad has won the war, because 30% of Syria is still under rebel-held territory. 30% of Syria, the northeast, sections of the north where the Turkish army is still there, training a new Free Syria Army. The U.S. forces are still in Manbij. Iranian forces are still in the south. The militia trying to protect the Shia crescent.
You know, Sammy,
Assad is not retaking
Syria
here.
You know, let's
Assad
be clear.
Is a puppet of Iranians.
You've had a very broad brush here, okay? Very broad brush, okay? You had your piece. Let me go to Marwa. Iran was mentioned here. Well, Iran is a sovereign country. Yeah. So is Syria. Syria, under the mantle of the United Nations,
a
United Nations charter, is allowed to invite a second country in to defend itself. So what Iran is doing there, plus, hold on here, Sammy, also, Israel's involvement, striking Syria 200 times over the last 18 months, you don't call that involvement? I would call that involvement.
That's nothing compared to the Russians, Peter.
All right, let me go.
That's nothing compared to the Russians.
Come on, let's have equal time. Marwa, go ahead. And Beirut.
Compared to the what, Russian? There are military agreements between countries. Maybe the military agreements only, for some reason, for certain people, they only fall on the shoulders of the West, but we cannot have coalitions, we cannot have alliances, we cannot have people who sign military agreements with one another. That doesn't have anything to do with what was happening on the ground. And another thing that I'm a bit confused about, you have rebels in the northeastern part of Syria, you have U.S. occupation in the northeastern part of Syria. We all know that. You don't have rebels on the south, you have Al-Qaeda terrorists who have been treated, who have been supported and have been funded by Israel. It's not an involvement whether they are striking Iranian posts or not. They take their warplanes, go illegally, go through the airspace of Lebanon, strike Syrian sovereign state, and then go back to their occupied territories. This is a war. It's not an involvement. Now, to talk more about Idlib, to go back to the real issue here, Idlib is a huge deal because it is the last resort for the terrorists inside of Syria. And yes, there's a huge involvement for Turkey. I do agree with that.
Yes.
And yes, Turkey has certain channels, communication channels open with the large groups inside of Idlib, mainly the Free Syrian Army. But the Free Syrian Army in several governorates have agreed for a reconciliation with Syria. We could get names and numbers and dates if you want. They did actually have an open channel with the government at the end because they don't want to see anyone dying in vain. But on the other hand, we have Jaish al-Islam, we have I think something with the Haqq inside of it, because there are more than Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and more which are directly affiliated to Al-Qaeda. They have openly said that they will fight till the last drop of blood. Well, there you go. Syria will have to retain control of that area. It will have to get the people out of there, just like it did in Eastern Ghouta. The people were blockaded. They were under siege because of these terrorists who were taking away the money, taking away the food. That's exactly the same thing in Idlib. And if you watch the Syrian national channel, you could see the people walking on foot, crossing the border now from Idlib, or on buses assigned by the Syrian Arab Army, and they say horrific issues because of these terrorists. They are no rebels. There was no revolution. I'm sorry. If we go back to Jisr al-Shughur and we go back to Dar'a, this has been the case since the early 2011 months. It is not a revolution. It was a pre-paid, pre-funded, and pre-organized war against Syria.
Okay, so I mean, let's stay with Idlib here. I mean, the Arab Syrian army has made it very, very clear that that is its next target in liberating the country, okay? And I'm glad that Marwa brought it up. The U.S. is illegally occupied area in Syria against international law. And we'll get to what America's vested interest is in being there in the first place later here. But it's very clear that they're going to take Idlib. Why wouldn't the people that are occupying it and their supporters in the country and outside the country have some kind of humanitarian vein of somehow separating them or having their terrorist friends get out of that city? Okay, because it's going to happen. Go ahead, Sam.
I think you're delivering your message to the wrong party. First and foremost, I find it extremely ironic that we criticize the United States for their involvement in Syria, but the Iranians and the Russians and the Syrian army
are
using the very same...
They are invited there. Let's be clear.
They are using the very same rhetoric that the U.S. uses.
Syria has a sovereign right to invite terrorist organizations. The United States is not invited there.
Peter, you're talking about a separate point.
The United States
point. Peter, you're talking about a different point entirely. Listen to my sentence. It has nothing to do with what you just said. My point is this, that the narrative you are using is the same narrative the US uses to justify Afghanistan and Iraq, which is that they are fighting terrorists. They are not fighting terrists in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I don't know what you're talking
about. Russia is not fighting terrorists
in Syria.
Some of the groups are linked to terrorist organizations. This is true, but they are not the majority. The majority are rebels fighting against a dictatorial regime, hell-bent on crushing the free will of the Syrian people.
Could you kindly provide us with names and numbers? A Syrian regime that has sent millions of Syrians into Turkey.
That has sent millions of Syrians towards Europe. This is the reality.
You guys, no one can hear us.
No one can hear us. One word we're saying.
All right, Sammy, hang on.
Peter.
Hang on. Sammy, I'll give you 20 seconds to finish up, and then we're going to go to the break. Just say it clearly so everyone can understand. Go ahead. 20 seconds.
Peter, the rhetoric that is being used by the people that you are representing in terms of the narrative you're trying to bring to the debate, the discussion, This is the same narrative that the U.S. uses. The U.S. says in Iraq, Afghanistan, we are fighting terrorists.
No,
this
they
false.
Create
Russia
terrorists.
And Iran are
they
saying
fund
they are
terrorists.
Terrorists.
They support terrorists. They give them diplomatic cover.
They
no,
are
this
fighting
is
the Syrian
what you're saying doesn't make any sense. All right, I have to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Syria. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Beirut here. A point about, you know, why the United States is there. Okay, first of all, the sovereign government of Syria has not invited the United States military to be in its country. It has invited, under international law and the UN Charter, it has asked Russia and Iran to come and to protect its sovereignty. That is all legal, and every country can do that here. Now, Marwa, what is the national security interest, geopolitical interest of the United States continuing this war? Because from what we've heard, that's exactly what they want to do. When the possibility, there are two different formats right now happening, I think it's going to be next week, attempting again to try to find some kind of path to this end to this conflict here. So, I mean, what does the United States really want to achieve here? It's very unclear unless it is chaos. Go ahead in Beirut.
It is. It is actually organized chaos with more resources and more marine routes and obviously to protect its main military base in the region, which is the Zionist entity, which is Israel. Now, what the U.S. wants, it could be actually chopped up into parts. It might want something in, let's say, in the eastern part of Syria, in the eastern of the Euphrates, and something entirely different on the southern part of Syria. So it's basically, it is connected to the border lines. It's connected to who's going to be the neighbor of Syria on that area. For example, they have a totally different strategy when it comes to the Kurds of Syria and Hasaka and Qamishli, but they have a very different one when it comes to Idlib, which is basically nothing, just like we said. But to go back to the U.S. presence, it's not only illegal, it is an occupation, and it gives every right for the Syrian government to find any sort of help to rid itself from this occupation and this aggression. I mean, look at what the U.S. is doing in Yemen. It has an entire coalition illegally bombing and blockading Yemen for 4 years. This is the exact same thing was supposed to happen in Syria, has it not been for the friends of Syria, and we're specifically talking about Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah. And I have
Hezbollah.
To put three dashes under Hezbollah because it is still exact, because it is still spoken in the mainstream media that it is a terrorist group when it's not. They basically protected us. They secured us. They secured my family to begin with from terrorists, and then they secured other areas with the help of the Syrian Arab Army. Now, back to what the U.S. wants from Idlib. Here is the question that resides with Turkey, with Erdogan himself. Look at what's happening in Turkey. It is a chaotic economic situation right now. Erdogan himself has said, I'm going to rid my country from the U.S. dollar, and that's a catastrophe, both-way catastrophe, because Idlib is very important. Afrin is even more important, and Minbij is even more important, which is in Aleppo as well. So all of these areas are basically a fight between what the U.S. would want to see in that area and what Turkey wants with Russia and Syria. Because now we have seen the rhetoric from Turkey against Syria is basically reciting because of the Russian intermediation between both states. And I think that after that, we might see
mediation
ties between Syria and Turkey.
Mediation, that's a key word here. Yeah. Sammy, I think all of us, we have different opinions on this program, and I'm sure our viewers do too. But Sammy, I think you and I can say this war should come to an end. How would you put it to an end? Go ahead, Sammy.
I think first and foremost, it's not Russia that's doing the mediation, it's Turkey. Turkey is the one that's gone to Moscow and Tehran and said, let me talk to the rebel movements and try to get them to withdraw. It is the Syrian army and the Iranians who are desperate to storm Idlib and cause one of the greatest humanitarian crises that we've seen in this particular war. With regards to Syria, it's a tragedy. Syria is a story of a people that wanted to rise up against a brutal dictatorship, one of the worst in the region, and Russia and Iran said, no, you stay under this dictatorship and you obey Bashar al-Assad. This is the reality of what happens. We can talk all day about the U.S., but the U.S. has no strategy.
Well, you know, but
the U.S.
Sammy,
has no idea what it's doing.
But
you didn't interrupt Marwa. You didn't interrupt Marwa. You did not interrupt
Marwa. Yeah, but she didn't.
The U.S. has
no
strategy.
I have to fact-check you.
So
I have to fact-check you. All
there
right?
is no fact-checking that you have to do with me.
Yes,
Peter,
I do. The U.S. called
occupied.
Assad
Where
a reformer.
Occupied?
Remember
the
that?
Are in
Remember that?
The U.S. The U.S. is not the moral code here. I'm not using the U.S. as a moral code. The U.S. is violating the region in Iraq and Afghanistan. Me and you can agree on that. Perfectly sound and fine. The Syrian people are innocent of the machinations of the U.S., of Russia,
but
and
Sammy,
the people.
I'm asking you how they rose to up against end
it
this conflict.
It will be
you
when,
want to go back to 2011.
The,
I want to stay
want to go
with
back.
2018.
This is
how
my
do
point.
We
this is
end
Peter,
this
be patient
conflict?
With me, Peter.
Come on, it's a simple question, it. Sammy.
No, you always stop me just as I'm about to answer.
But you're not
so,
answering.
Building on what I've said, the solution is that the international community comes to its senses. It backs the Syrian rebel movement. It pushes Assad
who
out
Who are
of
they?
Damascus.
Al-Qaeda?
It forces the Russians.
Al-Nusra?
The U.S. gives Ukraine to Russia
who?
And tells Russia,
I'm
look,
sorry.
If it's Ukraine you want, have
no.
Ukraine, but please leave Syria.
Who?
You
who?
Back the Syrian movement against a dictatorial regime.
I'm
you
sorry.
You try to bring
There's
about
no
a genuine
no
democracy.
All right, let me go to Marwa. Let
you
me give you...
What is a dictatorship?
Hang on,
about?
Hang on. You guys are doing it again. Don't
how
do it again. Sammy, don't do it again.
Do you sit there with a straight...
Don't
how do, you sit
do
there with a straight
it again.
Face?
Marwa, Peter, let me give you an example.
Peter,
no, Sammy, please,
yes.
Don't
you
filibuster.
Every sentence.
Don't
Peter.
Filibuster.
Peter.
We're almost out of time. Marwa in Beirut. Let me give you an example. The example
Peter,
of Aleppo. Remember the media
Peter,
hype? Aleppo
guest,
was going to be destroyed.
Peter,
it was going to be a humanitarian
guest,
crisis.
Peter.
But it never happened, did it? What happened was they went back. Can you cut his mic? Because I'm talking.
Exactly.
All right?
Give me the respect you
okay.
gave to
Marwa. No, I'm respecting the people of Syria after a war that never should have happened in the first place. Okay? So Marwa, let's use the example. Of Aleppo, okay, Aleppo.
Down a bit.
Go ahead,
Peter.
Marwa. Marwa, go ahead.
What I would
please.
Like from Sami is to, just to calm down a bit, and I'll just would like to ask him and everyone who has questions. It's legitimate to ask questions whether there was a revolution or not. But let us go and ask the Syrian people. When was the last time that Sami actually went to Syria? I have been throughout the war to Syria, talking to residents, talking to locals, talking to the people who have been through the war. I'm actually going to Syria back in 2 weeks now to actually talk again to those people and probably go to the front line as well to talk to more locals who have been fleeing the areas, because these are the people who have the stories to tell us. It's not me, it's not Sami, it's not the international community, because it's not there. What has the international community done to Yemen, to Libya, to Afghanistan, to Iraq? Absolutely nothing. It's a chaotic
Yemen
place.
Yemen is a Houthi military
a
coup. Let's not conflate examples.
Don't repeat the words.
Yemen
don't
is a military coup.
Don't repeat the words. Don't repeat the words of the mainstream media when they say
Yemen,
it's going to be
Houthi,
a worse
Houthi kicked out
a
government
Look
in Sana'a.
Yemen.
What
How
Middle
dare
East
they?
Are you talking about?
Okay. All right, Sammy, is in your opinion,
if you're talking about Syria.
Hang on here. We got a sound delay here with Beirut. Sammy,
go ahead.
Do you think that the U.S. is spoiling for a conflict with Russia and Iran in Syria?
U.S. is paralyzed on foreign policy. It has no idea what it wants to do. Trump wants to be friends with Russia. James Mattis wants to be enemies with Russia. The U.S. is paralyzed. We cannot talk about a U.S. foreign policy in Syria because it doesn't know what it wants to do. We can only talk about Turkey, Russia, Iran, Bashar al-Assad. We can't even talk about Saudi Arabia because it's now out of the balances
like
of power
the people who
completely.
Won the war.
The reality is, in Syria, today, you have Idlib, which is on the verge of a humanitarian crisis. Assad doesn't care about humanitarian crisis.
We've heard
this
before.
It's only the Russians who are stopping him right now. The Russians are stopping him.
Over and over.
The Russians are stopping Assad right now on Idlib, only because they're unsure how the U.S. will react. Because the U.S. killed 300 Russian troops a few months back. Russia is worried about what the U.S. will do. Russia is not bombing terrorists. Russia is propping up a dictatorial regime, bombing the daylights out of Libya.
The
Iranians have sent their militias to southern Syria. They have conquered it. And now Assad...
I've heard this one before. I've heard this one before. Russia intentionally bombs hospitals, but America accidentally bombs hospitals. That's the narrative in the West.
I'm not defending America, Peter. I'm not defending the U.S., Peter. I'm not a present... I don't present the view of the U.S.
Yes, you are.
The reality is,
Peter... Sammy.
The Turks are the only party defending the Syrian people.
You simply won't answer my question.
They are
how
looking
to
after
end
3 million
this
refugees.
Conflict. That's all
Iran
I want
is
to
not
know.
Looking after Syrian refugees.
How
neither
to
the
end
Russians.
This conflict?
The conflict ends. The conflict ends with the international community.
If you allow
comes
me,
to its senses,
I can tell you how.
Backs the Syrian movement and removes Russia and Iranian involvement
what
from
senses?
Syria and
when
allows people
ever,
the freedom to
when
choose
did they ever
their leaders,
have senses?
Not to prop up. Marwa, Assad family who have ruled for decades and oppressed their people.
I know where the opposition is. I know where the opposition is. They're waiting outside the outskirts of Langley, okay? And they'll be parachuted in when they're needed, okay?
But the issue is...
And that's exactly the game plan.
How should Syria end? I could tell you. How should Syria end? Syria should end by eliminating the terrorists, just like other governments were eliminated terrorists from, and by sending everyone back home.
There is no difference between what you and peace are saying in John Bolton. There is
everyone
no difference.
Take back
you
their terrorists.
You are both terrorists, saying there are terrorists. What terrorists? There are, a few groups of
sit down on the table and negotiate
create,
a new constitution
that
for
came
Syria.
About
there you
because
go.
Of the
war
fate
ends.
Of the international community. This is why.
The international community has failed all of these countries in the most botched foreign policy endeavor that's covered decades. Where was the international community? They were silent because it's the Washington consensus. That's why it's all failed here. And I think that all of us have failed the Syrian people because this conflict never should have happened. I mean, how many Uyghurs, Sammy, are fighting in Syria with terrorists? What are they doing there? No one asked them to be there.
Exactly.
No one asked the Americans to be there. No one asked NATO,
Germans,
NATO
British,
assets to
Americans.
Bomb the infrastructure of Syria. Okay, I suppose you're going to say Russia destroyed Syria. True. That is simply palpably untrue.
You're putting words in my mouth, Peter.
How?
I didn't say that at all.
Okay. Marwa, I'll give you the last word on this very spirited edition of Crosstalk. Go right ahead.
Okay. My last word would be that definitely these upcoming weeks are going to be very decisive weeks when it comes to Idlib. I believe we're going to see in Idlib the same thing that we saw in Daraa and Aleppo, a complete cleansing of the terrorists in the area, for people to go back, for institutions to work again, for the infrastructure to be built again, just like every part of Syria. Look at Aleppo. Now they're having festivals again. Look at Daraa. The kids are going to school again. So this is exactly what's going to happen in Idlib. But I think what's new here is going to be the Turkish stand. I think Turkey, Erdogan, will have to take a historic stance with Syria, with the Syrian government, and say, just as I allowed these terrorists to go in, I should allow them to go back to whatever they came from.
There was a time delay here. Sammy is absolutely right, and Marwa is absolutely right. Turkey is a key player here, and we'll be discussing it probably next week here on Crosstalk. Many thanks to my guests in London and in Beirut, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.